Thanks, Cale. What I'd like to share with you today is some of the work that I've been doing in my classroom in using game dynamics to drive student participation in the classroom. And so the overview of my talk today, I'll talk about some background about how I got into this and some background about how the theory behind game dynamics and where it fits into a theoretical framework, what game dynamics are and some examples of those game dynamics, and then how do those game dynamics fit into flipping the classroom. So for me, I got really tired going back into the classroom of students doing grade calculus, as I call it. And I remember doing that, and it's the whole like, well, how much do I have to get on this test or this exam or this paper to get a certain grade? And I got really tired of being asked, well, how many points is this worth? And can we have a practice test? And are there going to be points for that? And what about points for this? And what about points for that? And so what I wanted to do is shift the responsibility for learning back to the students and really focus them on, rather focusing on the points, focusing on engaging with material. And I participated in a teaching conference this past summer and listened to a professor at a small institution, Stephen Brookfield, and he had talked about having been there, and like him, I had been there as well. I remember doing all of these things, thinking about points and considering whether or not I needed to get an A, and well, I only have to study for 2 hours to get a C and I'll get an A in the class, so who cares? I don't have to engage with the material. And I wanted to get students out of that mindset. I also, at the time, came across Seth Priebatsch's TED Talk. If you're not familiar with TED Talks, just Google TED, T-E-D, and it's a talk where he talks about creating what he calls the game layer on top of the world. And it has a lot to do about Foursquare and checking in and things like that that are now very commonplace, but at the time it was pretty revolutionary. And I've also been gaming my entire life. I've been playing video games and doing various games. And so as I thought about it and read about how students are using these games and playing games, I thought about whether or not this would appeal to students in terms of their learning. So when we think about what game dynamics are, it's important to recognize that we're not talking about creating a game in the classroom in terms of they're playing a game. What we're using are the mechanisms that make games work, and using those in how we deliver content or do things in the classroom to engage those students. So game dynamics are feedback mechanisms that motivate players to progress through a game or a scenario. And from this gaming blog, game dynamics are rule-based systems that drive users to explore, learn, and experience their potential through the use of feedback systems. So a lot of the same kinds of things that we think about when we think about teaching and engaging students. The important thing to recognize is that we're already playing. Whether we're talking about losing some weight with Weight Watchers and keeping track of how many points a particular meal is, we're taking money off of our gas points or whatever. If we're Dr. Brosnan and we like to walk across the red carpet to go on to the airplane in Knoxville first, you know, we're earning miles. Our students are also playing. We've got fantasy football, the Tennessee Lottery scholarships. If you earn a certain GPA, you get discounts off your education. Xbox, Foursquare, checking in, etc. Dr. Kaminsky, of course, is a big fan of that one. If you follow him on Twitter, this is a game online that's called Eve. This is one of the most extravagant role-playing games. This ship here is one of their highest-class ships. It takes 8 weeks of actual time to build. Okay, so actual real time to build the ship. It takes hundreds of people participating in unison to build the ship, and it takes about $8,000 to build the ship. Okay? Now, the real question is, when the other team or another group of folks comes in to your game and steals this ship from you and then has the ship, can they be arrested for theft because you actually spent real money building the ship in real time? And it's an interesting perspective, because these are the kinds of things that people are doing with some of these game dynamics. A lot of it's grounded in this prospect theory, and basically this is a theory that Kahneman and Tversky won the Nobel in 2002 for, and it describes how people make decisions in various scenarios. So basically, people tend to be risk-averse in a domain of gains and risk-seeking in a domain of losses. So in other words, if you've made a gain and you don't want to put it at risk, then you tend to be risk-averse. And if you have nothing to lose, then you're willing to risk. And so some examples of those game dynamics that we see in everyday life and then in the classroom. One that we see all the time, happy hour. It's something that is prevalent. This is what we call an appointment dynamic. You show up at a certain time, you get a discount off your drink. Farmville is an example of a computer game or like a actual game that you play, where you show up at a certain time, you have to harvest your crops, and then you get points, and then you continue playing. In the classroom, attendance would be an example of an appointment dynamic. You have to show up in class, you get a certain amount of points. A status dynamic would be various credit cards. So you have various levels of credit cards, from the regular green card up to the black card. Badging systems and achievements unlocked are examples of status dynamics in actual video games. And one of the systems that is in use in some classrooms is a leveling dynamic, or a status dynamic, where you level up in terms of points rather than getting grades, and those points correspond to a grade at the end of the semester. A progression dynamic, so you're moving forward through time towards some goal. This is one we're all very familiar with, a punch card. You buy a certain number of cups of coffee, you get a free panini or a baguette in this case. This is a profile from a social site, where you create a profile and you can see the progression dynamic, that green bar down at the bottom, where the more information you provide, you progress forward through and complete your profile. This would be an example of a progression dynamic. This is not an actual progression dynamic that we have at UT, but something that would be nice to have, where if a student logged on, they would actually see you've completed 68% of the requirements for your BS in plant sciences. You have 7 requirements remaining. Click the button to get started, and then go into your registration process. So in the classroom, what I've done is I begin the class with a pretty simple statement. I start with, you all have an F, unless you decide that you don't want one. And so I use this progression dynamic where we, instead of earning losing points, we earn points and move up and level up. And what that does is it's a very subtle shift, but it creates this situation where, instead of being risk averse, they can put themselves out there and try to earn different things. And so we have a various number of assessments and attendance and exams, and the attendance is a small number of points, but I do it because it's that appointment dynamic that gets them engaged. I also have changed homework assignments, and I call them challenges. And for some reason, it's lost on them that it's still homework, but it's by calling them challenges and then making them voluntary, and then they're graded on a binary basis, so it's either acceptable or it's not. And the reason why I do that is because I tell them, in the real world, when your department head or your boss, your superintendent, asks you for a report or something, you don't get an 80%. And, well, you know, that was a pretty good try, Dr. Horvath. You got an 80%. That's not acceptable. Go do it again, or you need to fix this. So that's what happens to the students. So if it's not acceptable, they have to go back and do it again. And various examples, a glossary challenge. They can go back and take their missed questions from the exam over again and fix them. A Twitter challenge, YouTube video, a blog. An app author. I actually had a student a couple of years ago choose to write an app that he created a prototype app for a certain number of points. So it engages the students in being able to choose different things. This is an example of something that's going on right now in our history and impact of turfgrass class, where a couple of students have chosen to do a Twitter challenge. And so they're actually tweeting currently on Twitter about what we're doing in class, and there's a number of you that are following them, and so they are tweeting about what's happening in class, what we're doing in class, and then earning points for the tweets that they put out, and also earning points as they engage followers. So it's pretty interesting to see them, when I ask them a question outside of class, start to engage with me with material that they're not technically required to do because they're not in class, and they're engaging with the material. So as far as results, I've been collecting data over time, but our numbers are relatively small, so we're still building a cohort of data, but it's very clear that this engagement with these game dynamics is driving their participation in a way that's different than just sitting in class. So then the other thing that I've done is I've flipped the classroom and started doing video lectures and then doing active learning activities in class. One of the things that I did was kind of follow the method of this Lodge McCammon at North Carolina State University, who was doing a lot of work with K through 12 teachers. And I was intrigued by his suggestion that publication might be a higher level on Bloom's taxonomy. And he created this method of using a simple video camera, one-take videos, and a whiteboard method where you sit in front of these whiteboards and engage in a very kind of close, intimate way with your iPhone or iPad camera. So you're looking at the person that's watching this video and seeing them. It's not a voiceover PowerPoint or something like that. And the data that he had suggested that was much more engaging to students, and I found that to be the case as well. So I just mentioned that his statement with this idea that publication may be a higher level on Bloom's taxonomy. Of course, that's one of our goals, is to engage students at higher orders of learning. And so I've created a number of videos and started to put those up to YouTube. And the nice thing about this is that it's very low tech, in the sense that it's one take. If I don't like it, I shoot it again. It's on these whiteboards. I slide the whiteboards out of the way off the chalk tray, and I press record, I press stop, upload to YouTube, and I'm done. So I can do 4 to 6 videos in a couple of hours and move on. And so I can do a semester's worth of lectures in a couple of days with an engaged effort. And so it's been very effective for me in terms of being able to get content up and get it ready for students. The other thing that I do is I place discussion questions in the discussion box or the description box of the YouTube videos, and then those are things that we do in class to engage with the material in class. So this is an example of something that we do in class. So we were talking about various sports and kind of the hierarchy or phylogeny of sports, going back to some of the ancient sports. So this was a sport called Baku, it's a ball and stick game. And so the students had to look up information online, find that information, and then describe it, create a board themselves. And so then I go around the classroom, take pictures of those boards. Those go up to the Flickr site on our Blackboard, and then the students are responsible for that material as well. So they have to engage with that material in the classroom, and then they're also teaching the other students in the class through discussion about the various sports. So some of the immediate takeaways was when I first started doing this, it was like, wow, this is going to be really overwhelming. There's a tremendous amount of technology. Some of our folks at the OIT and Teaching and Learning Center were talking about all kinds of various technology to do these things. Once I found Dr. McCammon's method, I realized you don't have to use every piece of technology that exists. You know, there's all kinds of attachments for your iPads and whatnot. You can be relatively low tech and achieve something that's pretty dramatically engaging. How do you eat an elephant? I have a friend of mine that's in Navy Special Forces, and he talks about getting through training and realizing that you eat an elephant one bite at a time, just like anything else. And that's very true for this situation as well. When you start thinking about, wow, I have 45 lectures to record, and you start breaking it down, if you get lost in the numbers and the size of things, you have to realize that just get one done, get the next one done, get the next one done, and keep moving. You'll be done before you know it. You also have to set aside time. There's a tremendous amount of time involved in preparing this material. But once you have it done, it's a really rewarding thing to see it go into action. But automation is one of the keys for these dynamics to work. Blackboard is our learning management system. One of the things that they've just implemented in their recent update is a badging system that allows you to give badges out. So now when a student watches a video or a number of videos, I can automatically add points into their grade center. So I can set up some of this automation, and that's been very effective for some of the work that we've been doing. So some of our accomplishments, we've flipped a couple of classes that I teach, and we've had Lodge McCammon to campus to do a workshop and speak at our departmental seminar. Realized it's not all about the technology, and he also offers an online training program, so if you search his name, you can find that online, and it's free to do, and by the time you're done, you have about two-thirds of a semester's worth of videos completed with feedback from him and a colleague at NC State on your videos. These techniques are very powerful. In some ways, they seem almost manipulative sometimes, because the students, like the voluntary situation, they ask, they start doing the math, like, well, could I do 20 of those and get an A? And you, yeah, sure, you can do that. Do I have to take the final? No, it's voluntary. You don't have to take the final. Do I have to take this exam? No. And you, they start realizing that it's something it's a very powerful thing to engage students and make them engage with material in a way that's a little bit different than they're used to, and sometimes they're not quite sure how to take that. But at the end of the day, realizing that it's about the students and their learning and their engaging with the material is what's been the most rewarding and most important about all of this. So with that, I guess we'll have Cale come up and speak, and then we'll have our discussion. Thank you.
We have time, Dr. Horvath.
Any questions?
Field a question or two?
Sure. Yeah, Joey's got it.
What would you say is the thing about before you did it, it's kind of plus minus, is the paper acceptable or these kinds of things? What would you say is the overall quality difference in the work you get, like you think about it, but say similar kind of thing previously?
So the question is, what's the quality difference of the assignments versus the past? One of the biggest things that I've noticed is that they don't turn it in until they know it's ready. So in the past, when you have an assignment and you have a due date, very often what you're getting is the rough draft, where now, when they turn it in, they know it's ready, and they've looked at it, and they spent time with it. So my personal philosophy, I think students are much more capable than sometimes we give them credit, but that's mostly because what that first set of work product that comes in is relatively poor because of the nature in which they tend to work, and in a lot of cases we tend to work, I got to get that done. There you go. And then that first bit is, it's like, oh, that's not so good, try again. Where now with that binary system of, they know that I'm going to look at it and go, nope, I'm not even going to spend time on it. It doesn't even happen. It's just I can look at it and go, no. And I'll give them a little bit of feedback why. So now what I've seen is that they don't hand it in because there's no due date. I do set a date prior to finals, but that's the biggest thing that I've seen. Joey? So the recommendation on how often to re-record the videos is it's also a method to reflectively engage in a reflective practice of teaching. So you go back and view your videos, and very often I'll look at a video and go, oh, I could have done that better, or I could have said that better. So what he suggests and what a lot of others talk about is basically to go back and re-record those videos as you reflect on them and realize that you could do a better job on something than to go back and do that. And so it should be a continuous process of engaging and updating. But the goal would be, as that happens, it's not happening in big chunks. You can go back and redo a video here and there along the way.